This morning we were talking about angels, both sides. I don't know if we got that second side in there very well. But I said that we would take questions this afternoon. And before I go into anything, maybe I should ask you if you have questions or comments or thoughts. Well, be thinking about that if you don't. I did have a couple of things mentioned downstairs that I should cover as we can. One of them was about the sixth chapter of the book of Genesis and the use of the term sons of God. I said this morning that sons of God in the book of Job refers to the angels in the early chapters and then later in chapter 38. And the point is that it doesn't always mean that. It's obvious the expression sons of God doesn't always mean the angels. In the Bible, we have plenty of New Testament references that call us the sons of God, male and female alike. Galatians chapter 3. We are now the sons of God by faith in Christ Jesus. The King James said children of God, but it's really sons. Masculine gender there because women inherit as men in the kingdom of heaven. So we are now the sons of God by faith in Christ Jesus, for as many of you as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. That expression, sons of God, there obviously means us and not angels. So if it sometimes means sons of God and sometimes does not mean sons of God, what does it mean in the sixth chapter of the book of Genesis? That's the question. I'll read just the first four verses of Genesis 6 to give us the context here. And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. And the Lord said, My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he is also flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. There were giants, by the way, that's Nephilim in the Hebrew language, meaning fallen men, in the earth in those days, and after also, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Now, one very common interpretation of this passage argues that the sons of God were fallen angels who married human women, thus corrupting the earth. Some view this passage as a direct borrowing from pagan myth and find in it another reason to discredit the validity of the Bible. But the main contention is that the phrase, the sons of God, means angels. That is a common title for spiritual beings in the ancient Near East. That's true. And the book of Job uses that not only in the early part, but also the late part in one case in chapter 38, as I mentioned to you. All of those have a clear reference to angels. So proponents of this view argue that the Jews believe this mythological interpretation of the first four verses of Genesis, and they draw evidence for that from the Jewish Apocrypha and the Jewish pseudepigraphal literature, especially the Book of Enoch. There are really three books of Enoch, but the main Book of Enoch, First Enoch, as sometimes people call it, tells a version of the fallen angel story, according to this theory, suggesting that Enoch, the patriarch, failed in his efforts to save humanity, and therefore the flood came and took them all away. And some feel that additional support for the view is derived from the book of Jude, who seems to quote, in the minds of some, seems to quote from First Enoch. I think he's quoting from Enoch himself, by the way. But in verses 14 and 15 of the book of Jude, that quotation is made, as I'm sure you're aware. Having just referred to sinful angels back in verse 6 of the book of Jude, the angels which kept not their first estate, as I quoted this morning. The angels which kept not their first estate, but left their own habitation, he hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness, under the judgment of that great day. It's important to realize the term sons of God does not have to mean angels. In fact, neither in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, nor in any other book of Moses, is a specific reference made to angels as sons of God. Even in Job, the sons of God appear as good spiritual beings, in contrast with Satan, who is probably a fallen angel. I can't say for sure that Satan is a fallen angel because I can't say for sure that the passage in Isaiah 14 or the passage in Ezekiel 28 definitely refers to Satan, although there are indications that it possibly could have a secondary application to the devil. However that may be, This in Job, the sons of God are good angels in contrast to the bad. So I don't see any reason to use the book of Enoch as a model here, because I don't think it was inspired by God. And not only that, but it postdates Genesis by more than 1,000 years. It was just written by, so, you know, anybody can write an apocryphal book. You write it today and put it in your attic, and someday somebody finds it. Oh, look how old this is. There's something about something being old that tends to carry weight in a lot of people's minds. So I don't think that Jude was quoting from the book of Enoch, but even if he was, the passage he quoted says nothing about angels per se. Jude nowhere mentions intermarriage between humans and angels. And the Lord, didn't he say that angels don't marry? In heaven, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but they're like the angels. In Matthew 22, when the Sadducees came and questioned him about, you say that there's going to be a next world, and tell us whose wife this woman will be in the resurrection, because she had seven husbands, and then they all died and she died too. Whose wife will she be in the resurrection? They didn't believe in a resurrection, and they were trying to discredit that. So that was the context in which Jesus said, in heaven, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but they're like the angels of heaven. So angels don't marry. And if angels don't marry, how is it possible for them to come to earth and marry? So we have a problem there. Genesis 6 begins by naming two opposing groups, the sons of God and the daughters of men. I think it's no coincidence that in chapters 4 and 5 of the book of Genesis, there are also two groups described, the descendants of Cain and the descendants of Seth. Cain and Seth were, of course, two sons of Adam and Eve. Abel didn't survive, and there were other sons and daughters, but Seth and Cain are named, two surviving sons of Adam and Eve. Beginning with their founder, the descendants of Seth lacked positive spiritual attributes. The descendants of Cain, they lacked positive spiritual attributes. They were earthy, selfish, sensual, and they were an authority unto themselves. The descendants of Seth, on the other hand, which carried the bloodline of Christ, had qualities of devotion and consecration, communion with God, service, and righteousness. And these two different branches of that family were very different from each other. This is emphasized in Genesis 4, verse 29. To Seth there was born a son, and he called his name Enos. And then began men to call upon the name of the Lord. That might be rendered, they began to call themselves by the name of the Lord. They began to call themselves as the separate people of God. That seems to be what's indicated there in the original tongue, if I understand it correctly. Here we have the beginning, if not before right here, then here we have the beginning of God's separate people. So knowing this context, we can identify the Sethites as the sons of God. They were God's chosen people in the era before the flood. And the Cainites were the daughters of men, in that they had separated themselves from God. And despite the commendable history of the descendants of Seth, they did intermarry with the descendants of Cain. Through these spiritually mixed marriages, the Sethites failed to remain pure and failed to remain true to their mission. So by that, they jeopardized God's plan of salvation, seemingly leaving Noah the only righteous one among them. God preserved the messianic line that was going to bring Christ into the world by sending the flood to save Noah and his family, as well as to judge those who were unrepentant. So the sorry state of humanity following ages of willful disobedience came about in the wiping clean of the earth with the flood. But there never was, as far as I can see, a fantastic mingling of humans with angels to produce some kind of half-breed, half-angel, half-human being. I think sons of God saw the daughters of men and married them is referring to the descendants of Seth marrying the descendants of Cain and intermixing the spiritual with the non-spiritual. That's my understanding of Genesis chapters 4 through 6, when the sons of God seeing the daughters of men is mentioned there. Had another thing mentioned downstairs as well. And that has to do with certain instances, primarily in the Old Testament, where we have, and it refers back to some of the things Paul was talking about a while ago. Jesus was already back there. The Father said, let us make man in our image and after our likeness. And if grammar means anything in the Bible, and the Bible is the verbally inspired word of God, then all of its grammatical peculiarities are there by divine design and not by accident. And sometimes these subtle little employments of grammar is God giving us messages. The plural pronouns, therefore, are very important. Let us make man in our image. Jesus was back there already. And in the 11th chapter of Genesis at the Tower of Babel, in the 22nd chapter of Genesis with the sacrifice of Abraham, he's ready to kill his son, and at the burning bush, other places, that's in Exodus, but all throughout the Old Testament we have a number of instances where there appears a mysterious being having qualities and characteristics and traits that can only be identified with deity, and yet he's said to be operating for God or operating on behalf of God. This mysterious personage is frequently referred to as the angel of the Lord or the angel of Jehovah. That's Lord with capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, which was the translator's way of showing that that's Jehovah. The expression Jehovah appears over 6,000 times in the Old Testament. It's very, very frequently used, a very specific name. So the rendition here would be the messenger of Jehovah. Again, that's Malak for messenger in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, it's Angelos. But it's the messenger or the angel of Jehovah. But it does not always denote that order of created celestial beings that includes Michael and Gabriel and the other innumerable company of angels. Sometimes this expression, messenger, just refers to a messenger, and it doesn't have to be something that's created. And I think that's what's happening here personally. This is my personal view of it. I think that's what's happening in the passage that I have, these passages that I have mentioned. We're talking there, I believe, about the pre-incarnate Christ, the eternal Word, the second person of the Godhead. Yes, he is called Jehovah, but Jehovah is a family name applying to God and his triunity and anybody who's a part of that triunity. These Old Testament phenomena are sometimes referred to as Christophanies, meaning a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. If that's true, then they were previews, they were hints of the fact that he was going to come incarnate in the flesh as the God-man, putting on flesh and dwelling among us, John 1:14. Christ was all the way back there in the Old Testament. He's there by implication. He's there in type, but he's also there, I believe, in these various appearances, Christophanies made to the patriarchs and the prophets. So those two things were mentioned downstairs, Genesis 6 and the Christophanies, and I thought maybe we should talk about those before time slips away from us. Anybody else have any questions, comments, or thoughts? Yeah, Janet? I don't have any reason to think that did Lot know that the men that came to visit him were angels. I don't have any reason to believe that he knew they were angels. He might have. I can't say whether he did or not. I think he was practicing Middle Eastern hospitality when he did what he did about his daughters. He was also relinquishing his responsibility as a father in the way that he offered them to the men of the city. You know, he offered them. Who can believe it? You know, I don't know. I used to read in the Old Testament where it says, you shall not make a prostitute of your daughters. And I'd say, yeah, right, who would do that? But people do it. I've got a next-door neighbor that goes over to Thailand and buys girls for $200 to keep that from happening to them with their own family doing it. So it does happen, and you just think it's a different culture, but it's a sad and godless culture. that would do that type of thing. Lot should have died defending those girls rather than offering them. But nonetheless, cultural things sometimes take precedence over doing things God's way. To me, the fact that he would do what he did with his daughters with regard to those men that came wouldn't indicate that they were angels necessarily, or that he knew they were angels necessarily. So they looked like men. I mean, when I see a man, I take it as a man. I imagine he did too. That's my guess. Want to say any more about that? Okay, anything else, David?
You said you didn't know if the devil, Satan, was a fallen angel.
Yeah.
If he wasn't, what was
he? What was he? Excellent question. That's one reason I tend to believe that he was. Because if he wasn't, then he had to be created for some other purpose. Everything was created good. Everybody was created good. God looked at everything he'd made at the end of the creation week and said, "Behold, it is very good." So Satan, the one who became Satan, had to be created good. And if he wasn't an angel, what was he? I think that's an excellent question. Therefore, I tend to generally assume that he was. But when we go to basing that and thinking we're nailing it down with Isaiah 14 or Ezekiel 28, I think we need to always give the thought that we can't be sure that those apply to it. And if those don't apply to it, then we just don't have any much information about it. I believe he was, because what else was he? But I've met people that think he was just created as a good entity and became bad and was not angelic. He's certainly not human. Way above and beyond our capabilities. So that seems to put him in the angelic realm. Some people think he was an archangel. I don't have any reason to think that either. The Bible mentions one archangel, calls him the archangel, and that's enough for me. But he does seem to have a resplendent power that's above his own angels. He's got his own angels who apparently followed him when he sinned and got cast out along with him. Good question. You want to say more about that?
Not necessarily about that, but you mentioned the archangel.
Yeah.
And earlier this morning you were talking about the divisions or the organization. And I can't recall where it is, but Christ said, "You've been in charge of little here and
right.
done well. You'll be in charge of much there."
Right.
So evidently organization is going to apply to us also in heaven.
Right. Absolutely. God is organized. He's not the author of confusion. He likes for things to be decently done and in order. Paul.
Well, I had a good question, but I forgot what it was.
Oh, no.
But one question. Do you place the angels in the category of principalities, power?
Yes.
Is that where you put them?
Yeah. I think we have to, because Paul said in the 6th chapter of Ephesians, we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. He's contrasting them with humans, and the only other way to go on that is going to be the fallen angels or the demonic forces. That's the only other that exists as far as I know. So I think he's talking about the forces of hell there, the demons, that are still very active and operative.
I've often wondered if I could keep in mind that you said this morning that there were angels probably present in this room.
Yeah.
I wonder if I could keep that in mind, that there's an angel around watching over me.
Yeah.
And how do I know if it's a good angel or a destroying angel?
Well, I don't have any reason to believe that the angels of the devil can circulate around on the earth. We have a very special instance in the Bible where they were on earth, but it would seem that in order to be here, they had to inhabit a living creature, like a human or an animal. I think that was a special case. After all, we don't find that back in the Old Testament. What cases of demon possession or invasion do we have in the Old Testament? A lot of people would point to Saul. Well, there was an evil spirit from the Lord, a spirit of affliction on Saul, but he wasn't in Saul. And I see that as a difference. In First Samuel 16 through 19 there. That's different from demon possession in my view. In 1 Kings 22, we have the case of Micaiah where there was a lying spirit that went forth. But that's not a possession. That's not an inhabitation. In the New Testament, all of a sudden, bang, in the Gospels, we've got demon possession all over the place. What's going on there? To me, the demons were released in the days of Jesus so that he could show his power and authority over them. If he was going to be Lord of all, then he had to show his authority not over only over heaven and not only over earth, but also over the infernal region. And he did that when the demons were released in his day so that he could show his authority over them. Fully, probably a fourth of his miraculous ministry was the exorcising or casting out of demons. But he left just a few around for his apostles to cast out to show their apostolic authority. But as you get through the book of Acts, there's very little demon possession there. Almost nothing about it in the epistles. But in the synoptic gospels, you've got it all over the place. That has to be, it seems to me, a special case. And the demons themselves give a hint about what was going on there in Matthew 8:29. When they say to Jesus that they had inhabited a man and he was demonstrating superhuman strength, he would break chains even, which is superhuman strength. Chains are meant to restrain, and they do restrain. This man was stronger than he would have normally been because he had a legion of demons inside of him. When they looked up and saw Jesus, now this man had never met Jesus, he didn't know Jesus, but the demons in the man knew Jesus, and they said, "Jesus, thou son of David." How'd they know him? They'd been in heaven with him. Jesus created them and they'd been in heaven with him before they got kicked out. "Jesus, thou son of David, art thou come hither to torment us before the time?" Before what time? Before the time we're going to have to go back to those chains where your father has had us all these years. And they were having a heyday here on the earth, making people fall into fire one time and into water another time, and making people do things they wouldn't ordinarily do by possessing these people, even possess children sometimes. So in order to not to have to go back, they asked permission to go into a herd of hogs. Even that was better. Unclean as the animals were, considered by the Jews, it was better to go there than to have to go back. And the Lord said one word in response to that request. He said, "Go." And they went into the herd of hogs. They ran the hogs over the cliff into the sea where the hogs, if the hogs perished, then they probably had to go back. I think the indication is, at least as I understand it, that they couldn't just remain and haunt houses and circulate around. I believe God's good angels can be here. That was a long way to get to your question, but I believe God's good angels can be here. I see no reason to believe that God's evil spirits are anywhere but back where God put them when he originally kicked them out. They're still in chains, waiting the judgment of that great day. Now, I think they have a profound influence, but I don't think they're loose on earth like the good angels are. So I make a distinction there. I think if there is an angel in your house, it's a good angel. It's not going to be a bad angel. So we don't need to worry about the bad angels. Now, how do they work then, would be the next question. Am I supposed to be taking another question?
God spoke to Moses in the burning bush.
Yes.
And he also gave him the law.
Gave him what?
Gave him the law on Mount Sinai.
Yes.
And yet it speaks of angels bringing the law.
Right.
And angels also speaking to Moses through the bush.
Right. He was ordained by angels in the hands of a mediator. Yes, there were always angels involved in these things. And even though they're not brought up in the narrative every time the story is told, there will be an occasion where it is told. The angels were heaven's delivery service, heaven's messenger service. And they were involved at the giving of the law and at the burning bush.
I've had some discussions before about when was Satan kicked out of heaven.
Yeah. And I think there were degrees. There were evidently degrees of that. I believe that he was originally kicked out, in a sense, back when the demons were his angels, very, very early, maybe even during the creation week. I'm not sure just when it happened, but it happened early enough that he was waiting to use the serpent on Eve there in the garden. It doesn't read like much time had passed. We really don't know how much time had gone by, but I don't think it was much. But he wouldn't have done that before he'd been kicked out of heaven. However, then at the time of Christ, Jesus also says, then now is Satan cast out. So when Satan killed Jesus, succeeded in getting Jesus killed, I think there was another, and John 12, John 16 both relate to this. There was another casting out of Satan. Satan was cast out of heaven, but it seemed like he could still go back there sometimes. He wasn't chained the same way his henchmen were. because he shows up in the book of Job. There was a day that Satan was before the throne of God, and all the sons of God were there, but Satan was there, and he has this conversation with God. Where have you been? Been going to and fro in the earth and up and down in it. So I don't think he can do that now because he's been further restricted since he killed Jesus.
I've always thought it would have been at the crucifixion when he was cast out.
Yeah, right.
Maybe that was when he was cast out for good.
I think that's the casting out that's the most enforced and most permanent. Yeah. But prior to that time, Jesus did say, "I saw Satan as lightning fall from heaven."
Right.
Past tense. So something had already happened, but something was still going to happen. I think it occurred in stages.
So given what you said about the demons not roaming the earth, what does 1 Peter 5:8 mean?
Yeah, he's talking about your adversary, the devil. I do believe that he is still roaming, seeking whom he may devour, but not the demons, which are his henchmen. They're still back in the chains, if I understand correctly. And the demons operate today through seduction and instruction rather than in personal invasion or possession. And I would base that in part on passages like 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1, written rather late when the Apostle Paul says, "Now the Spirit speaketh expressly that in a latter time some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons." All false doctrines originate in hell. The demons of hell, enchained as they are, think up these false doctrines and attempt to place them into various people's minds. That's what I understand there. Otherwise, how can you give heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons? The demons, who are very intelligent, think these things up and look for minds that are susceptible to these things. Muhammad, outside of Mecca, said that he saw Gabriel. Well, maybe he did see somebody who said they were Gabriel. I don't know whether he did or not. Maybe he made it all up. Or maybe there was a demon who somehow was able to project the idea that he was Gabriel. Even Satan himself was transformed into an angel of light. Again, we don't know as much about this as we'd like to, just where the powers of Satan are limited. But I think that the Islamic religion, which, in spite of the fact that we have politicians all the time talking about how it's a great and noble religion, Islam is a false religion thought up by the satanic forces and foisted on the world to where one out of every five people now on earth is a Muslim, a billion people deceived by this false religion, that may have had some demonic help getting started. Joseph Smith may have had some demonic help starting Mormonism. He talked about going into the grove, you know, and he saw the Father and the Son. You've read the varying and conflicting accounts that Joseph Smith gave in the early years of Mormonism. Maybe he did have some demonic help getting that started, or maybe he made it up himself. But, you know, the Mormons are always saying, well, how could an ignorant boy start a religion like this? Well, maybe he did have some help. I don't say that he didn't. So I don't know all about it, but I know there are such a thing as seducing spirits, and there are doctrines of demons. And since they're reserved in chains, I think they do this through transmission, through the spiritual equivalent of radio waves, whatever that is. There are radio waves in this room right now. We're not hearing them because we don't have a receiver. But if we brought a radio in here, we could probably get 100 different stations. All those waves are in this room right now. Similarly, I think the demons who are restrained in these chains, they can't get out physically, or they don't have physical bodies, but they can't get out corporally, can't get out bodily, but they can apparently project these doctrines so that people on earth will give heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. Otherwise, I wouldn't know what 1 Timothy 4:1-2 would mean. Speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry, commanding to restrain, commanding to abstain from meats and so forth. We know when that happened. It was long after the New Testament era, and yet it was still people giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. So I think they're functioning now in that capacity, sending these radio waves out, looking for susceptible minds. Not every mind is susceptible, but some are. And This is, again, a reason why we need to compare everything to the word that God gave us. I appreciate your assistance very much. We didn't get too much of the other side in there, but we got some of it in there for the lady that asked it. She was telling the people downstairs who she was, but I'm still not going to tell you. It was a very good question. Thank you for that. I'm glad that we've had this little opportunity to cover it together. And hopefully it promotes further study on our own. Let's conclude once again by extending an invitation song. And if you have a desire to respond to that, the front seats are open. Let's stand and sing together, Kevin.